Pretty much everything that you guys have done is graded now. I don't think there's anything else. And I'm very, very proud of you guys. You guys are doing really good stuff. And so it makes me really excited about what your papers are gonna look like. Because the collective groan.
I don't know if you'll trust me.
But man, because I mean, I've met with everybody except for I think four or five of you now for your papers, or maybe less than that, maybe just three or four. I don't remember. I have some more today that I'm meeting with, and then I think that's it. I don't remember. Anyway, I have some more to meet with you. But man, even the meetings I've had with you guys, they've all been really good. I've been really excited with where you're headed. I hope you didn't walk out of any of those meetings distraught or upset or crying like Kyle apparently was. I'm not really sure. Yeah, I'm loving it. I think we're really heading in a good direction. So obviously, if you have more questions or concerns or whatever, shoot them my way. But you really seem like you're heading in the right direction and starting to really get what we're talking about. So you had something to say?
Yeah, if we haven't had something, like one of our grades come back to us, does that mean something's missing maybe?
I don't know.
I actually have them in my backpack right now.
Okay, never mind. I was like, I don't know. I put them in a box and then they disappear. So, but not your mailboxes. I put them in my other box in my office. Oh, okay. So yeah, so you'll have them all by the end of this afternoon. Yeah, any other questions? Anything you're confused about, worried about? You will have in what chapter next Friday? Over the whole book. So that's how you learn it.
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
This might be a little, I don't know, but in the commentary, the Swami's commentary, I sometimes he uses the terms the church militant and the church triumphant, and I just call it short of me.
The way the church fights and the way and the church as the win. Even if you want to look at, I don't have his context in front of me, but I'm assuming that the church militant would be earth oriented, and the church triumphant would be heaven oriented. That's probably what he's getting at. That'd be what I'd assume. So time period wise, that'd be hard to establish because eventually all the church would be church triumphant. But right now the church is militant because we are fighting on the earth. But keep that word in context, because it's an explosively violent term that's used for a pretty non-violent group in Revelation anyway. Yeah, any other questions? That's a good question. If that, what I said right there, doesn't match up with his context, then write me a context word. Okay, yeah, that's what I would guess. Anything else? All right. We will talk about your papers probably next week, just to kind of give you a better idea of. I think though that I've pretty given you a pretty good idea as far as what I'm looking for whenever I've dealt with you one on one. But I will open up for questions next week about that, since it's going to be due in a couple weeks after that. So, all right, we're in Revelation chapter 13, verse 3. Do I want to start off with a theory? I revealed to Drew a theory, I think even Tom, that I'm wrestling with. Maybe Shane. Yeah, question?
I'm supposed to remind him about books.
What books?
If they borrow books.
Oh yeah, if you've borrowed books from me for Revelation, please come tell me after class, because I don't mind letting people borrow books unless they're Revelation books, and I get a little nervous, because those are my babies. And my Roman books, my SRF Price, I know who's got that, but I know I've let like four or five of them out, and I just don't remember any of them. I usually write them all down when it happens. So, yeah, I think Natalia's got one. But anyway, so I'm just, after class, come tell me. If you don't mind, I'd appreciate it. Yeah, I'm playing with this theory. I even am tempted to turn off my microphone right now because I don't really know if I like it or not. This is something I'm going to pursue for my PhD. I'm letting you guys in on it. Just so that as you're going through it, if you find things that can maybe help build this and help me construct this, I'm serious. I'd like to know. My PhD, the whole question I'm asking is what do we do with symbols Or what do we do with events in Revelation that have Old Testament connections but no Old Testament precedent? Like, for example, the release of Satan. Where do you find that in the Old Testament? So I have a whole, when we get there, I'll tell you my whole theory that I've argued. Actually, it's in the book too. You could just read it in the book. But I have a whole theory of that. And what I'm doing is I'm saying, well, if the Old Testament doesn't give me the prime imagery of it, then where do I go? And my argument would be, well, to Rome. Why? Because Rome was communicating with the predominantly illiterate group of people, and the way they do that is through images and through stories and through stories and through myths and things of that nature. So, one of the questions I have, and Tom possibly has an answer for this, although I don't think that his answer negates my answer. I think he could just build it in a different direction. One of the questions I have, though, is, number one, in chapter 13, why are there two beasts? Because in Daniel, there are four, but the four beasts in Daniel each represent what? Kingdoms. Here we have two beasts, and they're supposedly representing one kingdom, although I think it's more complicated than that. But why two? Whenever there's only one referent. That's a question for me. Then my next question is, how come in chapter 17 is there only one beast? That's weird. What happened to the other one? No talk about it until chapter 19, when he's not even called a beast, he's called a false prophet and thrown into the lake of fire. What happened to the one? Why did it go from two, which is odd to begin with, down to one? Why didn't he just start with one and just have one? Like Daniel did. Like 2 Esdras does. I mean, it's an apocalyptic image with the one beast coming out of a sea that represents a kingdom. That's very normal. But the two beasts, one from the sea and one from the land, all of a sudden we're dealing with some imagery that's getting a little bit different. Another question with chapter 17 is, why is the harlot representing Babylon? Because in the Old Testament, who does the prostitute consistently refer to?
Israel.
So what do I do with all this? Here's my theory. In chapter 12, we had this dragon come on the scene, correct? And what was the dragon's primary purpose? Throughout the whole chapter, what was his purpose? To do what? To make war. Whether it was with the woman, whoever the woman is. Hopefully Drew will tell us who she is. I would like to know. To make war against the woman, to make war against the child she was birthing. And then at the end of the chapter, the dragon is then bent to make war on the offspring of the woman, right? Let me tell you a story. Supposedly, in 735 BC or thereabouts, was the founding of Rome. As the story goes, there was a Vestal Virgin, and this is before Rome began. There is a group of Vestal Virgins, which these are religious women that are set aside for perpetual virginity. And they do things within the temple itself, and worship cultic practices that were even practiced throughout the first century. But their practice of the Vestal Virgins goes all the way back to the before Rome began. So there's Vestal Virgins, and they're there. And there's one in particular Vestal Virgin that catches the eye of Mars. Who is Mars? The god of war. And the god of war comes to this woman. He impregnates this Vestal Virgin, and she's impregnated with twins, two babies, one named Romulus, one named Remus. Romulus, if you know Roman history, is considered to be the first king of Rome. Matter of fact, this was interesting. Whenever I was in Rome 4 years ago, they had just made a discovery that they think may even point to a historical figure named Romulus. Possibly in Rome. That day they discovered it and were letting it out. Which that's interesting. But anyway, that hasn't anything to do with the story. Remus and Romulus were born. Well, whenever the king Arminius found this out, he was livid because the Vestal Virgins are supposed to be pure. So he takes the babies after she births them, he puts them in a basket and throws them in the river. Now, it sounds very Mosaic. Throws them in the river. As they're going down the river, all of a sudden a she-wolf pulls them out of the river and suckles them to maturity, which is why you will see in Rome a lot of times, you will see a wolf that's standing over two babies and the babies are getting milk from the she-wolf. Because that's their origin myth. That's how their kings came to be. So the she-wolf pulls them out, suckles them to maturity, then eventually they're adopted by a family in the nearby region. So they go and they grow up there. Remus and Romulus grow up there as brothers. Well, when Remus and Romulus come of age, they finally go back, find the king that threw them into the river, kill him, take their great-granddad, and promote him as the king over that city. And then they go back to the place that the she-wolf pulled them out of the river. And what they find there are seven hills. Huh? What is that? Where are we at? Rome, where Rome eventually is built. And Romulus grabs what's eventually the Palatine Hill. He starts building a wall around it. Well, Remus starts making fun of him. He's like, that wall is not going to be able to hold anyone out. And he goes, let me show you. Remus hops over the wall. And so the story goes, before he even landed, Romulus kills Remus. Well, Romulus then continues to build the city up. And what eventually starts populating the city is a bunch of criminals and people that are running away from their respective countries. That's who is the original population of Rome, which one Roman scholar I was reading by the name of J.P.V.D. Balsden, that's his name, J.P.V.D. Balsden, he said that the enemies of Rome could not have come up with a better origin story for Rome. Because literally all their ancestors are a bunch of criminals. What ends up happening is they don't have enough women to satisfy all these criminal men. So on one of the nearby hills, they go over, and while those people are out in war, they steal all of their women. And then when the people come back, obviously they're upset. I believe the guy's name is Statius. That could be wrong. Anyway, the king is upset. They come to war with Romulus, and basically the women go in between both of them. And they stop the war and they say, "Let's not fight. We can come to a compromise." And so what ends up happening is Romulus says, fine, I will be king and so will he, and we will rule as a one city. And that's what they did. And this guy eventually dies, Romulus becomes the sole king, and Rome is born. Okay? Here's my theory. Like the Remus and Romulus myth, the god or the image, the deity, of the, or and I don't, deity is a little bit too grandiose. But that is bent on war, ends up calling forth two. He is the progenitor of two agents that carries out his war throughout the world. Here it's the dragon with the two beasts. There it's Mars with Remus and Romulus. Well, why then does it shift from two beasts to one? Well, as the story goes, there eventually is only one, because Romulus slays Remus. And so whenever we come here, whenever the harlot is in full fruition, Romulus is the one that's considered the actual original one, not Remus. Now, if this is right there, if I stop right there, you'd be going, you know, maybe. Here's the kicker for me. This is why I think it's possible. The Latin word for a she-wolf is lupa. It's the Latin word for a she-wolf is lupa. It is also the Latin word for a harlot. Oh, that's awesome. I actually found a first century document of a group that was making fun of the origin of Rome. And they retell the story in a pretty interesting way. But instead of a she-wolf suckling the two twins, it is a harlot. And they purposely are using a play on word with the Latin word for harlot and she-wolf. Basically saying, you're not the children of the gods, you're the children of a whore. So, is it possible that what we have here, the reason why there's two beasts that are representing one kingdom, which is not Old Testament-like, that eventually shifts to one beast, which I don't know why he didn't do that to begin with, and there is a harlot that's not Rome, or that is not Israel, but it is actually Babylon, Rome. Is it possible that it is the origin of Rome's story laying behind it? That's what I'm going to try to argue at some point. I don't know. Anyway, as you're researching, if you think that you find things that either contradict or support that, throw them my way. But that kind of sets up what we're moving into next. He calls them forth from the first one from the sea. He had 10 horns and 7 heads and 10 crowns on his horns. Why is that significant? Have we heard that before? What's that? He looks like the dragon. There's only one difference. What is the one difference? What's that?
Numbers of horns and heads. The first one is 10, 7, 10, the other one
horns?
Yeah, the first one has 7 heads, 10 horns, 7 crowns. This one has 7 heads, 10 horns, and 10 crowns. But the connection is there. It is not the exact same one, but it looks an awful lot like it. Why? Because that's who has called it forth. That's the progenitor of the first beast. He will also be the one that calls forth the second one. Blasphemous names on his heads. Da, 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 da. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. We talked about that the last class period. Three out of the four, because the fourth one's so grotesque, of the beasts in Daniel 7 combined together into one. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. Now, who gave the dragon his power, his throne, and his great authority? So who's really in control of this story? See the issue? One of the heads of the beast seemed to have a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. We've already talked about that. The whole world was astonished and followed the beast. Ooh. Men worshipped the dragon because he had given the authority to the beast. And they also worshipped the beast and asked, "Who is like the beast? Who can make war against him? Who can stand?" Is what you almost hear. Remember, I told you one of the key words we're going to be looking at in chapter 13 is parody. That same type of questioning sounds an awful lot like what was asked of the Lamb in chapter 6, verse 17. Who can stand? This guy is so big and cool. Who can stand? The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies and to exercise his authority for 42 months. Huh. What does that immediately tell me because of the way that phrase was used in chapter 11? What is his purpose? Close. The word there that you said is one word that I like, that's misused, but I like. What is his purpose? Persecution. Of who? Whom? The saints. The church. To trample the holy city for 42 months. See? What is the purpose of this beast? To persecute the saints. To make war. Mars, to make war against the world and conquer it. Wrong one. Okay. The beast was given 42 months. Verse 6. He opened his mouth to blaspheme God, naturally, and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. He has given power. He was given power to make war against the saints and to conquer them. See, this is one of the things I don't like about some of the movement. That this is one of the things that I'm trying to critique also with what I'm writing right now. There's a movement right now, it's called the Empire Studies. Well, that's what I call it, the Empire Studies. Richard Horsley is a big advocate of it, Warren Carter, Neil Elliott, even Richard Hayes to some extent, which I actually really love the stuff that they're studying and doing. I really do. But what I don't like is that they call it anti-imperial. I don't like that, because anti-imperial basically says that everything that is being written or talked about in the gospel or in the New Testament is to only to tear down Rome. But what I'm suggesting a different title for this type of literature. I'm going to call it alter-imperial. And the reason why is because alter-imperial can include both. Number one, it can include elements of anti-critiquing Rome, but it can also include elements of complicitness, which is what I think is happening here. Rome says, we have been given the power by the gods to conquer the world. An anti-imperial statement would say, no, you haven't. But that's not what you see in Revelation. What does Revelation say? Yeah, they have. They have been given the power to conquer the world. Now, don't get me wrong, where it becomes alter-imperial, or even some sense anti, depends on how you look at it, it becomes that way whenever they say, but who gave that power to you? That's the subversion. But to suggest that every statement is anti and undercutting Rome, as far as like what they're claiming, that's to overstate the reality. The reality is, Rome says they claim the world, and Christian story says, you're right. But the Christians also say, who gave you that power? And what will your ultimate, what will you doing ultimately end up in for you? as the harlots being devoured by the beast in chapter 17. And the Christians would also say, I understand that how you define the word conquer, but do you know how we define the word conquer? So they're not denying what Rome is saying. They're developing an alternative empire, an alternative reality. Anyway.
So when it says conquer here, it's kind of talking about the worldly sense of conquer necessarily, kind of like when the two witnesses are conquered, it's kind of the world focus of you've killed them, so you've conquered them. But then to us, we redefine conquer to mean we have gained victory through what you think you're doing. Is that what's being said here?
Well, I mean, this is militant. This is military language. In other words, this statement wouldn't even shock us after the fifth seal, because we've already been told that the Christians will die during, you know, by the hand of Rome, by the four horsemen riding. This isn't shocking news. I was even saying this to somebody, I think this morning. You can see a recapitulation even in chapter 13 of what we've already seen with the four horsemen and the locust. It's the same story, told from a different perspective with a different purpose, right? What do we find? Evil ransacking the world that's under the hegemony of God, that's destroying even the church that will ultimately bring about His purposes. Same message. Now it's being told under the story, what I think of possibly the origin myth of Rome, but being told for a different purpose, explaining why they are experiencing the persecution. Why? Because Mars has stirred up his people. Yes, so he's given power to conquer them, to destroy them. And he was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation, something that Rome claimed. And Revelation says, you do have that power. Yeah. But here's something that's interesting. The word earth is used 70 times in the book of Revelation. 45 times it is negative, 21 times it is neutral. Think about that. Earth is hard, and you want to know whenever earth is used in a positive way? New heavens and new earth. Matter of fact, the number one name for people that don't belong to God in the book of Revelation, earth dwellers. So whenever he says, we rule the earth, Christians would say, okay. Okay, of course you do, because that's where you belong. You see what I mean? Do they really rule the earth? Yes and no. Yes and no. Because they've been given the power by whom to actually rule the earth? Well, the one that gives the power is the one that's really in control. Okay. All inhabitants of the earth, that word actually right there, the word used for inhabitants of the earth, that's earth dweller. All the earth dwellers will worship the beast. You know one of the number one name that's used for Christians in Revelation? Holy ones. Hagiosmos. Saints. Which has a pretty close affinity to non-earth. See what I mean? Matter of fact, this will be very important for a throne word study. My throne word studiers. One of the things that none of you pointed out, and that's okay because this isn't something you were supposed to, was that in all the times that the word throne is attached to evil, every single time it's attached to the throne being on earth. And every single time the word throne is attached to God, Jesus, or the saints, it is every single time used for their reigning in heaven. The only time that I would have to say that there is only one time whenever the throne of Jesus and His saints is ever used on the earth, that would have to be in Revelation chapter 20, verses 4 through 6. What is that? You might know what that is? The thousand-year reign. But what's interesting is we assume it's on earth, but the word earth never appears in 4 through 6. All we see is Jesus reigning on a throne with the saints. And if I use the throne word study to tell me where we are, it would say, He's not on the earth. He's in heaven. Why? Because every time the word throne is used attached to God, Jesus, one of the saints in Revelation before chapter 24 through 6, it's been in heaven. And every time it's been used attached to Satan or one of his minions, it's been on earth. This would be the only anomaly, and I have no other internal evidence to prove me that. Right now you'd be going, I have no idea what he just said. Well, when we get to chapter 20, you'll know. That's just a precursor, foreshadow, if you will. All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the book of life, belonging to the Lamb that was slain from the creation of the world. He who has an ear, let him hear. Where have we heard that before? chapter 2 and 3. Oh my gosh, he said it at the end of every one. He who has an ear, let him hear. What is that indicating? What is it driving at, that phraseology? I'm about to call you to an ethic. I'm about to call you to an ethic. Matter of fact, he who has an ear, let him hear. Always follow was what followed his description of them needing to overcome. How? By the way they live. So he says, he who has an ear, let him hear. And immediately the seven churches' ears peek up and they say, okay. So you're going to tell me about something, how to live. And what does he say? If anyone is going to captivity, into captivity he will go. This is how we win. If anyone is to be killed with the sword, by the sword he will die. This is how we win. Oh, I thought Revelation was a violent book. It is. But never once will you find in the entire book of Revelation violence being done by Christians. It's always done by God, Jesus, or the dominions of Satan. Always. That's fascinating to me. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. Absolutely it does. This is not an easy teaching. This is not something that's just like, oh, that's easy. Let's go out there and be killed by the sword. No, I don't care who you are. The fact is that mystery always incites fear at some level, even if you're comfortable with living in the fear. It always does. And I don't know of any other mystery besides death that's even more magnanimous than that one. Then I saw another beast. So now we have two. Here comes Remus, or, well, depends on how you look at it. Coming out of the earth, he had two horns like a lamb. He had two horns like a lamb. Well, the last lamb I saw had seven. But he spoke like a dragon. What's that? What's the word I'm looking for to describe that? Parody. Boy, he looks like a lamb. He sounds like a dragon. What's he saying? He's a wolf in sheep's clothing. That sound familiar? Man, there's sometimes that you'll be in a church and you'll be talking with people and you're going, man, you come to service every Sunday and even Wednesday nights and in small groups, but man, when you talk, all I feel is venom. It's strange to me. That's this beast. He looks like a lamb. Man, he sounds like a dragon. He exercised all the authority on the first half of the... First, let me stop and say this. What does the first beast represent? I am going to argue that that while Rome is reflected in the beast, Rome is not the beast. Why would I say that? What's that?
The beast transcends Rome. Like Rome is the example of the beast.
Rome is the puppet of the beasts and the dragon. Rome is the manifestation of what the beasts and the dragons are desiring to bring about on the earth. But when you have in chapter 17, the harlot who is defined in verse 18 as the ruler of the kings of the earth, you clearly see that Rome is the harlot. But the harlot is devoured by the beasts. And the beasts continue to live on in 10 kings. See what I mean? So what you do is you have this. You have the beasts. You have the harlot. And the harlot is riding the beast for a while. But eventually they get devoured. And the beasts pick up another harlot. And there have been many harlots throughout the history of the world, haven't there? The really dangerous question for application is, who's the harlot today? Oh, let's not go there. Let's not go there. Because there's a lot of people vying for that title, it seems. You know what I mean? There's a lot of people vying for that title. And if they don't have it right now, they're doing whatever they can geopolitically to make that their title. And no, I'm not just talking about the country we live in. I'm talking about this is the pursuit of governments in the world. This is what they do. Because what does the beast offer? What do the dragons offer? Power over everything in the earth. Whether we're talking economics or militaristic, doesn't matter. That's what they promise. I don't know of, there's very few governments that's not their desire. Okay. The first one, though, represents the more political aspect of the two. What you're going to find in the second beast is it's much more of a religious aspect. A worshiping, constantly trying to get them to worship the first beast, pointing back to the first beast. Think of it almost kind of like this. Think of it almost as kind of like a trinity. You have a father, which would be parodied by a dragon. You have a son, who's very political, by the way, has a kingdom that rules the earth, that there's a beast from the sea. Oh, beast from the sea. And then you have a spirit whose job is to constantly point us back to the kingdom, to draw us into kingdom, to convict us to be a part of the kingdom, to pursue us, to point us back to this. And that's kind of like what we'll find in the second beast. It's a religious aspect. It's a worshipful aspect. The first beast, if I'm going to put it in language that's even maybe more summarily. Yeah, I don't know if that's even a real... It's a real word, I just don't know how to say it. It'd be... The first beast stands for anti-Christian government. And the second beast would stand for anti-Christian religion. But here's the thing. There is no separation of church and state in the ancient world. And guess what? I would even say there is no separation even today, no matter what we say. We act like it. That's not true. It's not possible. Why? Because every government, every land, in order to be unified, has to have some sort of civil religion. They always have, and they probably always will. We're the first ones to try that experiment, but even notice now what's happening. We're backlashing. Where everything we do is sanctioned by Yahweh. Well, that's bold. See what I mean? Religion and politics are always interwoven. They're always interwoven. We don't need an imperial cult for that reality to be true. We look at the Muslim nations and we're like, oh, those archaic people, they just can't keep their religion out of politics. And you do? How many presidents have stood up in our country and said, I am an atheist? Any one of them? Ever? Why? That won't get you elected here. So to say that religion and politics have nothing to do, that's just foolish. Just foolish. Yes?
Is there such thing as a Christian government then outside of the kingdom of heaven?
No.
Sorry.
I don't understand how that would make sense. And the reason why is because governments of this world, how do I say this? They have different agendas. They have different goals. All of them. I'm not talking about democracy versus communism or anarchy. No. All of them have different agendas than what the kingdom of God has said. I don't know a single government that says our goal is to give all of our money away to the poor. Really? Well, that's dumb. Politically speaking. Religiously, it's beautiful. I don't know a single government that just says we need to love our enemies. Really? I thought whenever you had enemies, you bomb them. Isn't that what we're supposed to do? Their agendas are different. You cannot have conquering of this world the way in which the kingdom of God articulates the way conquering exists. So no, but that shouldn't upset us. You know, the fact that we don't have a Holy Roman Empire should not befuddle us. You know what I mean? My word, we haven't had one for 2,000 years, and the church's doing okay. And that longing inside of us for one is the longing for the ultimate new heavens and new earth, not for what we have right here. So what's our job right here? To let the world devour us as we love those around us. It's how we win. I don't know a kingdom that functions like that. A kingdom that would say, if they come to bring you into captivity you would go. What government says that? If they come with the sword, by the sword you will be killed. Who has ever said that? So I don't know how it's possible for our agendas to lay next to each other and say, they're the same. Many people would disagree with me, and I'm okay with that. I'm more asking the question. I don't know how that's possible. And I know many have tried. Many people that are way smarter and better than me have tried. And it's always turned. Even Calvin in Geneva, whenever he was trying to create that, Calvin turned into a tyrant at the end of his life. Killing people, all kinds of people. Even one guy who was passing through his city sniffed out that he didn't like what he was saying, killed him. Many people better than me have tried it. It's never worked out. But you know what? We don't need a land. Our kingdom is transgeographical. It's transgenerational. We are living in a new creation. This is what I was just talking about in my Christian life class last hour. All of what I'm saying makes sense if you realize that the resurrection inaugurated a new creation. We are that new creation, 2 Corinthians 6. We are a new creation. Therefore, the way we function shouldn't look like the rest of the world. Why? They're living in the old creation. It's characterized by things that are different than what we are characterized by. It should not shock us that Jesus didn't come back. This is a question that I have that I think can answer even some of this. Why didn't Jesus come back and establish a government? He could have, couldn't he? Do you know where the kingdom's very first originated? 1 Samuel chapter 8. Remember how that was talked about? Whenever the nation of Israel says, we want a king like the other nations. And Samuel goes to God and he says, they've rejected me as a prophet. And what does God say? No. They've rejected me. By doing what? By asking for another king and another kingdom. And God says, throughout the rest of 1 Samuel, he says, let's give them what they asked for. If that's what they want, fine. You know what your kings are going to do? They're going to enslave you, Israel, so that you can give them what they want. Money and power. That's what you want? You don't like my judges methodology? You think that that's not going to make you succeed? You want to be back in Egypt? Fine! And Jesus comes on the scene and we say, why didn't you give us another kingdom? Another king reigning on earth like the other nations? And Jesus says, because I'd be sanctioning the very thing that was rebellion to begin with. It does not shock me that Jesus comes down here and he says, I'm not going to sit you up on a throne on earth. Because that was couched as rebellion in 1 Samuel 8 to begin with. It'd be foolish for him to go back and say, yeah, you guys were right. Because they weren't. And the whole story of the Old Testament is showing us how that was not right. Even the best king was a liar, a murderer, and an adulterer. So my question, a lot of times whenever people are asking that particular question, I know that's not what you were saying, but eventually it gets to the point is, why would we want that? I do agree with Martin Luther, whenever Martin Luther was asked, why don't you become king? He said, why would I do that? Why would I step down from being a preacher to something like being a king? I love that. Because what that's saying is, I'm already a part of a kingdom. It's way bigger than what I could ever do, sitting on a throne. I'll leave that to other people. I've got other things to do. Why? I'm living in a new creation, baby. Of course I'm not going to make any sense. The cross is foolishness. Well, it depends on the criteria with which you're judging it. We've got to get through chapter 13. Okay. Verse 11, then I saw another beast coming out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. I already said that. He exercised all authority on the first beast on his behalf and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose fatal wound had been healed. Notice he brings it up again. The Holy Spirit points us back to Jesus because of his resurrection. So too the second beast of the first. Because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the first beast, he deceived the earth dwellers. Notice who did he not deceive? The Hagias Mas, the holy ones. He ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. Worship an image. Let's call him a god. He was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast so that it could speak and cause all who refuse to worship the image to be killed. I'm going to let those that are writing on chapter 13 tell us about the imperial cult. We've already talked about it some, but there's a lot of parallels here. He also forced everyone, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on his right hand or on his forehead. Oh my gosh, we're getting into some crazy stuff, man. So that no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name. Oh my gosh, I know where we're going. This calls for wisdom. Of course it does. If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, for it is man's number. His number is 666. Man, I love it. It was like four summers ago. Went to McDonald's and bought two Happy Meals. $6.66. Oh yeah, the lady even giving it to her, she's like, I'm sorry. And I was like, you're cool. It's all right. I used that as my bookmark to read the whole Left Behind series. I did. I still have it in my office. Here is my question. Is what John is trying to get us to be afraid of right now a microchip that's going to be put in my forehead or my hand? Is that what John's wanting the first century Christians and me to hear? Be careful, Shane. Because one day, all of your credit card information, your social security number, will be put into a little microchip, computer microchip. If you don't know what it is, those in 1500, you'll learn about it in 500 years. And they're going to put it into your head. And when you walk in, they'll be able to track you. And that is the mark of the beast. What about UPC codes? You know there's a 666 combination UPC codes. Maybe that's what he's talking about. Or even better yet, maybe it's Ronald Wilson Reagan. His first name has six letters, his second one does, and his third. See that? Or maybe it's, Martin Luther said, maybe it's the Pope. And he finagled some words of the Pope in order to make it read 666. Or maybe the Catholics say it's Martin Luther because they finagled some words and make his name say 666. Or maybe, you see the issue? What is it? Or is it? I actually have on my blog a video arguing that Barack Obama is the Antichrist and they attach it to 666. What is John trying to get his church to be? What is John trying to get his church to look out for? And maybe there's a more simple answer to this than what we've been told. Matter of fact, my chapter in the book on this particular verse and this issue, I call Simplifying the Number of the Beast. Because it actually is pretty simple. If you take away all the junk, it actually is not that difficult. Does it take wisdom? Yes, but wisdom is an ethic term. Not a code-cracking cipher term. It's an ethic term. This calls for wisdom, church. What is it? What are the options? Well, we've had a lot of options throughout the years, as I've already kind of mentioned. One of the biggest ones, though, was that it is Caesar Nero. Caesar Neron. Neron Kaiser in the Greek. Why? Because if I transliterate that into the Hebrew, Kaiser Neron, it actually adds up to 666. 666. If you take the Greek, transliterate it into the Hebrew, add it up, it equals 666. That's fascinating. It actually is. So does Caligula's name. So does the words Latinus. Irenaeus gave us that one. So does pretty much every other emperor you can think of, even Domitian, adds up to 666. One of the reasons why this is the most popular one, though, the Nero one today, that's the most popular. And the reason why, too, is because we have a textual variant in this passage. And it is not just 666. We have a strong textual variant of 616. As a matter of fact, Pioxyrhynchus 115 is a document that actually, which is from the 4th or 5th century, that actually shows 616 in the document itself. One of our oldest manuscripts has 616. Not the oldest, but one of the oldest. And, if I want to make this even worse, Irenaeus in the 2nd century, when he's talking about, in his Against Heresies 5.30, he's talking about 666. He says there is another tradition that doesn't give us six decads, that gives us one. What is he pointing to? 616. He says, and this has led them into all kinds of crazy things, which tells me this. Even by 180, we have evidence of a 616. You see what's happening here? If I'm a textual critic, one of the things I do is I look at, and usually I will lean towards the more difficult reading of a passage. And 666 is very smooth. 616 is more difficult. Therefore, if I was arguing as a textual critic, and I actually have in here people that do argue for this, most textual critics would say that this is the original. Do I agree with that? No. But What this does tell me is this. We have to deal with 616. Whatever your interpretation is of the mark of the beast, you have to deal with this because its testament is within 70 years of Revelation being written. That's substantial. You see what I'm saying? You following me here? So whatever answer we give needs to explain 666 and 616. And Kaiser Nero does. Because if you take the Latin form of the word Kaiser Nero, Kaiser Neron, it's actually Kaiser Nero. You lose a final noon that would be in the Hebrew, which takes away 50. Now all of a sudden you're going, whoa, maybe Nero is right. I have six reasons why I reject the Nero interpretation. Number one. Number one. No early church evidence ever suggests Nero as equaling 666. The very first mentioning of Nero as 666 is in 1831 by a German scholar. Can you shut that window for me? That's driving me crazy. My word. We're an education institution here. But did you hear that? The very first time that Nero is suggested as 666 is in 1831. Well, if I'm not going to give rapture much of a hearing, I maybe should question the Nero interpretation. I have the exact person that says it in this book as well. Number two, Nero is, in the 5th century, in a document called the Liber Genealogus, it is, in the 5th century, used to equate 616, Nero. But it's done a little different. Now, let's look at this methodology. It's not transliteration into the Hebrew and things like that. That's the methodology that we have from 1830. 616 in Liber Genealogus, what it does is it takes Antichrist, translates that into Latin, adds it up, and it equals, I believe, 154. Then they take Nero's name, four letters, and they multiply it by four, and it equals 616. Notice the methodology, though. How different the methodology is. It's nothing like what I described before. It's totally different. So that makes me think, huh? So this is a fairly new idea, this Kaiser Nero, Kaiser Neron. Third, this does not explain to me why there was an early shift to 616, does it? It gives me an option for an equation, but it doesn't answer the question, why 616? It tells me what it could be, but it doesn't tell me why it is that way. Are you following that? You following me? Why all of a sudden I'm just like, maybe I'll put them into Latin, and then we'll add it all up too, and we'll have an early textual variant of 616 and 666. That doesn't explain anything. It gives me an option, but it doesn't give me an explanation. Number four, why does John call Nero Caesar or King? At this point, the first 12 chapters of Revelation, wouldn't it be odd all of a sudden John's like, and King Caesar? You know what I mean? Isn't that a little odd? I think it would be. I don't think he's going to give him an honorific title. Here's my sixth reason. Why would he even do that? Or no, my fifth reason, sorry. Why would he give an honorific title of Caesar in a cipher? In a code? Why wouldn't he call him Donkey Caesar? Wouldn't that make more sense? Or Donkey Nero? You know what I mean? Why in a code is he going to call him an honorific title? Number six. Because the beast, we've already talked about this, symbolizes something bigger than Rome altogether. And so to try to summarize the beast with the name of a Caesar, to me seems a bit odd. So what are our other options? Well, here's the one I've landed on. It's actually really pretty simple. Chapter 13, verse 17. Unless he had the mark, which is... So he's identifying now the mark. Couldn't buy or sell. Unless he had the mark, which is what?
The name
of the beast. Huh. Chapter 15, verse 2. And I saw what looked like a sea of glass mixed with fire, and standing beside the sea, those who had been victorious over the beast and his image, and over the number of his name. So what am I looking for when it comes to the number? Name, right? Okay, here we go. Ready, Greek scholars and Hebrew scholars?
Yes.
The Greek word for beast is therion. Beast. Okay? Now, here's what we're going to do. We're going to transliterate this into Hebrew. Okay? There's the towel. Resh, they, re. I always have to look at this because I always mess it up. Yod, vav, nun. Oh, sorry. Therion. So if I was going to pronounce this, therion, therion. Okay? Now watch this. This is what's really pretty fun. The towel's worth 400 in the Hebrew alphabet because each of the Hebrew words or letters were attached to a numerical value. It's the way they taught their kids how to read and how to count at the same time. As a matter of fact, this is a pretty normal ancient practice because we even have examples in Pompeii. In Pompeii, you know what happened to Pompeii in 79, Mount Vesuvius erupts. And really, what's the word? It freezes that society in history. And the more we've uncovered it, the more we've actually seen what a real ancient city of the first century would have looked like because it was frozen in time. You actually have people that are still, you still have them in a sense frozen today, cuddled up in the corner because the ash came and preserved them. One of the things we found was some graffiti, and on one of the graffiti on the wall in Pompeii says, "I love her whose number is 545. How would you know who he loved? You'd have to use gematria. It's what's called gematria. Gematria. Where you would take the value of the value of the numbers of her name and turn it into a number. And the only way you'd know who she is if you took the number back into her name. Matter of fact, this actually was used against Nero. Suetonius describes that there is, he says Nero's name, and then he says, who slayed his mother. And if you take the last half and add all those up into numbers and Nero's name, they actually equal each other. So he's making fun of him by using gematria. This is something that we even have in ancient Christian documents. A lot of this is documented in here, so I'm not going to regurgitate all of it. The point is, this was something they did a lot. Even in Roman settings, in Greek settings, and Jewish settings. Tau is 400. Resh would be 200. Yod equals 10. The Vav equals 6. And what am I missing? 50. What does this equal? Oops, bad 5. What does this equal? Wouldn't it make sense if the name Beast equals 666? And it does. He tells me in 13:17 that is the number of his name. 15:2, the number of his name. What is his name? Therion. What does that equal? 666. Isn't that somewhat logical? Somewhat simple? Or let's build on this. Chapter 14, verse 1. Name of the beast is beast. Name of the beast is beast. Do we have another name for the beast? No. Do we? I'm saying this. Let's keep it simple. Here's my question. If it is this simple, do we have a better option at this point? The number of his name. Whose name? The beast's name. What's his name? Well, let's try beast. It works. Why would I be looking for anything else? What compels me? Curiosity? Not logic. Because Therion, beast, is 666. That's what it equals. But let's build this. Let's build this. Chapter 14, verse 1. Then I looked, and there before me was the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, with him 144,000 who had his name and his Father's name written on their foreheads. Whose names? Jesus and God. Let me do, this is something. I only put this in a footnote because I don't know if I can totally prove this, but I did come up with this. Arnion. What is that in Greek? You may know what that word means in Greek. Arnion. lamb. I have evidence also that what was something called the nomina sacra, a way of referring to God's name without writing out his whole name, was used in the middle 3rd century. And in Greek, it would be theos. It would be symbolized with a theta and a sigma. Now, watch this. This to me is more than intriguing. If I transliterate those two, the name of the Lamb, which is Lamb, and the name of God into Hebrew. Okay? So we have my Aleph. Let me do this. So that way. That should be a resh. Where's my book? It's in my note. Here, I'm going to write what I think it is, and then I'll see if it's right. Arneon. We'll try that. I'm going to go right here. That's fine. There it is. Okay. That's not right. That's not the right. 15. No, that's not the right one. Here we go. Daggone it. They left out a letter. No wonder I'm confused. Erg. Ah, that makes me mad. No wonder that was messing me up. Because Resh is 200. Ah, daggone it.
What's your third letter?
Yod. 10. 5, 6. Noon, 50. And that should equal 317. They left out a letter. No wonder I was confused. 317 is what this should equal. It should be R with a resh. That's a misprint in footnote 44. They misspelled my Hebrew words. I don't know. Maybe I did that. I doubt it. But maybe I did. I'm sorry. Page 303. Arneon. Aleph, resh, noon, yod, Vav, noon, would equal, 200, 1, 50, 10, 6, 50, 317. Then if I take the name of God, theta, sigma, and put that into Hebrew, we would have a tau and a samek, which equals a 400 and a 60. What does that equal? Ooh, that's interesting to me. It equals 777. And who's that name on? What number would that be? Who is that on? It'd be on his people. You see, the name beast is planted on the name of the people that belong to him. The name lamb and God is planted on the name of the people, or the planted on the forehead of the people that belongs to them. Why? Because whenever you live for God or for the beast, it's as clear as if it's planted on your forehead, like a phylactery box. Deuteronomy chapter 6. Which we do have evidence of Jews putting a phylactery box on their forehead and on their hands, don't we? What's he saying? What's Deuteronomy 6 even? What is Deuteronomy 6? The great Shema, right? Our Lord, our God, the Lord is one. Well, how often are they supposed to say that? Every day. And he says, whether you are laying down or whether you're walking, doesn't matter what you're doing, every day, you need to have this on you, the God's name and God's word on your head and on your hands all the time. So they developed boxes. And the boxes cried out to everybody that walked past them, what? This is who I belong to. And he says, man, I'm telling you, people that worship the beast, you'd be like stamping them on the forehead with the name beast. But you're stamped on the forehead with the Lamb and God. I can see you. We're going to see in chapter 17 a prostitute with something stamped on her head too, right? mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes, and the abomination of the earth. Why? Because what you do characterizes who you are. And who you are, you can hide it for a little while, but it's all over you. Because in Revelation, worship is war. Who you worship is who you're stamped by. It not only seals your fate, it seals how you fight. Now, I haven't answered one more question, and let me do that. How does this Therion junk answer 616? Because I've answered 666, but how does it answer 616? What I need to do is I need to get rid of a noon. Because then I'm down to 616, right? Anybody have a Greek Bible in here? Thanks. Turn with me to Revelation chapter 13 in the Greek. Chapter 13, verse, I believe 17. Okay, verse 17. The very last time that the word beast is used is in what form? Genitive. How would I pronounce that? Theriu. If I was going to transliterate it into Hebrew, I couldn't have the lexical form therion. I'd have to lose the noon, right? What I think happened was this. People were misinterpreting that 666 equal beast because the lexical form wasn't what is closest to it in the actual manuscript. So what happened early on was they said, no, because you're missing it, it's not just 666, it's 616. Why? Because I'm going to get you to the closest lexical form or the closest form of the word beast in the text itself. And the closest form, the closest reference to the word therion in the Greek is theriou, the genitive form of or from. And if I'm going to transliterate Theriu into Hebrew and add it up, it equals 616. See what's happening? Let's make this simple. The number is the number of his name. Who is his, who is the his in that sentence? The beast. What is his name equal? If it's in the lexical form, 666. If it's in the closest reference to the actual text that we're dealing with in 1318, 1317, it's in genitive form. Therefore, it's 6162 as well. Not 6162, 616 as well. See what's happening? What is the number of the beast? Is it a computer chip? No. Matter of fact, if they're going to do computer chips just to make a point that I can't lose my salvation by getting a computer chip put in me, I'll be the first one to put it in. Why? Because can you accidentally lose your salvation? Any more that you can accidentally get it? No. It's not the way it works. It's not the way it works. In the Left Behind series, something really ticked me off at one point. It was in the Unleashing of the Darkness Plague of the Bulls. So we're talking like the 11th book. And Nikolai Carpathia's secretary, they're all shrouded in darkness. They can't see. If they don't belong to Jesus, they can't see. So they're in darkness. And Rayford Steele is actually in Nikolai Carpathia's office sneaking around. But he can see because he's in the light. And all of a sudden, the secretary said, someone's there. And he knew he was caught, and he was kind of freaked out. And basically, as the course of the conversation goes, she said, you're one of the light, aren't you? And he said, yes. She said, can I be one of the light too? His response was, I'm sorry, you've already received the mark. Why? Did she even know what she was doing? Where in the gospel does it tell me that if I accidentally receive a mark, that it doesn't matter what I do, I can't come to Jesus? Where does it tell me that? No. The mark that's on your forehead is who you belong to. And when you become a follower of Jesus, you are stamped with His name. You are covered in His blood. You belong to Him, whether we can see it or not. And he does look at the church as Asia Minor and he says, I should be able to see it though. This calls for wisdom. Ethical talk. Who do you belong to? The beast or the lamb? Check my forehead. See the answer? You see what's happening?
So when it says that you won't be able to buy or sell goods, mm-hmm. somewhere, it's not saying something that you have an actual mark and say,
no,
they're not going to want to associate with you because of who you belong to.
Yeah, it's saying down to the very base of sustenance, the way that you live, it will come to a point, it doesn't matter what you're involved in, your mark will be very clear. We do have evidence of being a part of a trade guild and having to receive an actual mark saying that you have worshipped the emperor. We do have evidence of that. Do I think that's exactly what he's talking about here? No, but it is in that ball field. Why would I say it's in that ball field? Because the way in which that you took part in their economic system was through oppression or buying into the system. And what he says is, even if you have to reject the whole system, you be looking for the mark, not for the system, not for providing for yourself, for the mark. See? It's ethics. It's the way you live. That's stamped on your head. Which is, we will also see that stamped on the head of not just 144,000, but even in the New Jerusalem, they receive a new name as well that no one else could pronounce. It's on them, etc. Then I looked, and there before me was the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. Where has the 144,000 appeared already? Chapter 7, exactly right. In what chapter? And I heard a sound from heaven like the roar of rushing waters and like a loud peal of thunder. Huh. Heard those before too, right? Where have I heard that? The roar of rushing waters was what? Chapter 1. Voice in chapter 1. What about the loud peals of thunder? Where have I heard that? Chapter 4, chapter 8, chapter 11. And they sang a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and elders. Where are they? What? Huh. So, I thought the 144,000 in chapter 7 were on earth. But where are they now? What does that tell me? What? It's over. Everything's over. We're at the end of time. Again, right? What's going to happen after this, you're going to agree with me, because it's the harvesting of the earth in a very gruesome way. No one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. Notice, they're taking, I mean, they are not earth dwellers. They belong to a different place. Kind of like saying, you're not citizens of this world, you're citizens of heaven. These are those who did not defile themselves with women, for they kept themselves pure, those Jezebels. They follow the Lamb wherever He goes. They were purchased from among men and offered as first fruits to God in their land. That almost reminds me of chapter 6. Offered on an altar are the martyrs who are crying out beneath the altar. No lie was found in their mouths, Revelation 21:8. Sing it with speed, just kidding, don't. They are blameless. Then I saw another angel flying in midair, and he had the eternal gospel to proclaim to those who live on the earth, to every nation, tribe, language, and people. For he said in a loud voice, fear God. That's the eternal message of the gospel? Fear God. Yes. I'm sorry, on a day like today, whenever an 8.9 earthquake erupts, a tsunami slams, and the whole world seems like it's crashing down around you, the command to fear God makes a lot of sense, because you realize in those moments how small you are and how big something else has to be. You know what I mean? That's why I think right now Japan in the next coming weeks is going to be ripe for the gospel. Am I saying that God did those? No, I'm not saying that. Am I saying He didn't do those? I'm not saying that either. I'm not saying anything about that issue. What I'm saying is when people experience stuff like four horsemen riding on their backyard, man, fear God makes sense. Maybe it'll even bring you to repentance. Fear God and give Him glory, because the hour of His judgment has come. Worship Him who made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and the springs of water. A second angel followed and said, fallen! Fallen is Babylon the Great. That's the first time I've ever heard Babylon the Great mentioned in the book of Revelation. And yet it's already destroyed. Huh! That's funny. That's good humor right there. I don't know if you're catching that. Fallen is Babylon the Great, which made all the nations drink the maddening wine of her adulteries. We'll figure out later that what she's actually been drunk on is the blood of the saints. A third angel followed them and said in a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast in his image and receives the mark on his forehead or on the hand, he too will drink the wine of God's fury, which has been poured full strength into the cup of his wrath. What is he saying? Worship is war. If you worship the beast, then you know what side of the battle you're on. If you worship the Lamb, then you know the side of the battle you're on too. He will be tormented with burning sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and of the Lamb. Somebody, I think Stephen, were you talking about this? And I do agree with this. Why? That is sick. That sounds sadistic. You're not thinking in honor-shame terms. When? How long until you avenge our blood? I'm going to show everyone how I avenge my blood by making the people that killed you on display for everyone to see because they've refused to repent even after killing you, even after I gave them the command to fear God. And the smoke of their torment rises forever and ever. And there is no rest day or night for those who worship the beast in his image or for anyone who receives the mark of his name. I could have added that one too, 14:11. This calls for patient endurance. Ooh, what does that sound like? Ethical talk, yes. Chapter 13, verse 10. This calls for patient endurance. Revelation chapter 1, verse 9. I, John, a brother and companion in the suffering in the kingdom and the patient endurance that are ours in Jesus Christ. Patient endurance is something that characterizes the Christians in Asia Minor. We are 2 minutes over. I'm almost done. This calls for patient endurance on the part of the saints who obey God's commandments and remain faithful to Jesus. Now listen to this, because we're about to hit another beatitude. Then I heard a voice from heaven say, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. What? That's not the way kingdoms are supposed to rule. Oh man, blessed are those that die. Man, blessed are those that die. Yes, says the Spirit, they will rest from their labors, for their deeds will follow them. If you had any question whether or not this was ethical talk, that we were in an ethical discussion, I think that the screaming of the Spirit at the end of verse 13 lets you know what we're talking about. Blessed are those who die in the Lord from now on because their deeds will follow them. What you do matters. What mark is on your head is betrayed by who you worship and how you worship Him. Therefore, he who has an ear, let him hear. Overcome the subtle seduction of the spirit or the satanic spirit and the physical persecution that sometimes comes along with it. Love you guys. Have a good weekend. See you next Wednesday where we will continue to make through this book.